So modern Chashon Mishpat, really all Chashon Mishpat, but in particular, for reasons that we'll discuss later, modern Chashon Mishpat is really the intersection of three areas. We have, of course, Halacha, the Shulchan Aruch Chashon Mishpat. We have Minhag, prevailing custom, and we have the law of the land. As we'll discuss, you know, these three, the interrelations between them are complicated, and there's a great deal of overlap. Of course, Halacha has the final word. Halacha controls. Halacha tells us when to follow Minhag and when not, when to follow the law and when not. But it's important to understand, even though in all of Halacha we follow Minhagim, the custom and Nisr V'Heter and Kashrus and Shabbos, you know, the poskim often invoke Minhag as an argument for or against some practice. In Chashon Mishpat, Minhag plays a very special role. There are really three rationales behind Minhag in Chashon Mishpat. First, we have Minhag where we have it all over Halacha. Anytime there's a doubt or a question of which opinion to follow, Minhag may tell us which one to follow. That's a general principle in Halacha. But in particular in Chashon Mishpat, there are two other aspects to Minhag. One of them is that especially in contractual issues like landlord-tenant relations, like employer-employee relations, these are essentially contractual issues. And Minhag may very well dictate, in the absence of any contractual stipulation to the contrary, Minhag may dictate how the contract should be interpreted. If there's no contract at all, or if the contract doesn't specify certain details, Minhag may determine. And as we'll see, there are many poskim who use the law as a minhag, who say that the law generates a minhag, and that's one very important rule. Besides the formal rules of Din Malchusa, as we will see, many poskim argue that the Din Malchusa creates, under normal circumstances, a minhag. The third aspect of minhag is that minhag may be a sort of takana. In Chashon Mishpat, unlike in Issur V'Heter, where if something is treif, it's treif, and if something is kosher, it's kosher, and you can always make chumris, but if something is asur, it's asur, and generally we follow the halacha, Mamonis is very flexible. The Chazal can make takanas, people can make, local cities can make takanas, and Minhag in certain contexts has the status of a takana. As we will see, many poskim again, we'll see the overlap between Din Malchusa and Minhag, we'll see the idea that the Din Malchusa can be a Minhag, which may have the status of a takana. So the point is, we'll discuss much more concrete examples later. But the basic idea is that whenever you discuss a Chashon Mishpat question, you have to understand these three areas: what the halacha itself says, what the prevailing custom is, and what the law is. I remember several years ago, several of my colleagues and I we were on a trip to Eretz Yisrael, kind of professional development. So we were hanging around the Bate Din in Bnei Brak, just seeing how they do things. So one night, one Matzei Shabbos, a colleague and I were sitting in on Rav Mendel Shafran's Dinei Torah. Mendel Shafran is one of the senior, most widely respected Haredi Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael. So I remember being very struck by the fact that for the several hours we were there, he rarely pulled a sefer off the shelf. Most of what he did was, you know, from memory, from Shara, the one time I remember him pulling a sefer off the shelf, he pulled off Rabbi Yosef Rasner's Mishpat HaPoelim. Not to look up a halacha, but the back of Rabbi Rasner's book has an appendix which basically summarizes Israeli labor law. The question involved, I think it was about a pension or some kind of severance package, and these things are, as we will discuss, often governed by the law of the land. So he doesn't have a law degree, I guess, but the way to do it is Rabbi Rasner has conveniently summarized for us law, and as we will see, this represents one attitude of the poskim that whenever that is. Especially on a contractual issue like employer-employee relations, Minhag is important, and the law will very often be important because the law, in the absence of any other factor, will often determine what the prevailing custom is. On the other hand, it's important to acknowledge that we find in the poskim a very different perspective too. Many of the poskim very often express a tremendous discomfort, a tremendous leeriness with the wholesale importation of the law into halacha as a customer as anything else. The Shvus Yaakov, for example, kind of grudgingly accepts that the early poskim in certain contexts accepted laws, but he says only what they did because they saw that those were karov tzas l'din Yisrael, those laws were similar to our laws. He says, but chas v'shalom, if you say that, if you simply follow the law, hatara tachkar sak, that the Torah is going to be abandoned, everyone's going to go learn the laws. He said, if we don't learn the laws, how are we going to know? We're going to have to consult lawyers for every case, and we can't trust the lawyers. That's a theme of the post-Kamako too, that even to the extent that we would like to follow the law, what is the law? Is the law what a judge says? Is what a sitting judge says? Is the law what the lawyers say it is? Which lawyers? You know, the lawyer's not always going to agree. That's a practical question, but we find that the Rambam Batum Wall Survey and Abschitz, we find many poskim have expressed a grave concern, a grave reluctance. It would be considered an insult to Taurus Yisrael to go overboard and to simply adopt wholesale the laws of the Goyim. So again, so we're going to see if we're not going to be able to solve the problem in one day, and there is no real resolution. But we'll see today, hopefully, different attitudes of the poskim toward how much, to what extent halacha recognizes the law of the land, either as a custom or as binding in its own right. One just very interesting, provocative instance of this question concerns intellectual property. Intellectual property is not primarily a contractual issue, and today what we're going to discuss is mostly contractual, but I'm just going to mention this because it's just a very interesting perspective on the law, the custom of halacha. The Shaul Meshiv, Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson, writing in the 19th century, he was one of the first poskim to discuss in the modern concept of intellectual property. Intellectual property in halacha is a huge topic. We're not really going to get into it today. There are literally entire svarim written on it, thousands and thousands of pages. And basically, it's something of a mess because there's no real sugya in the Gemara about it. So the shaila really comes up more in contemporary times, 19th, 20th, 21st century. And the poskim have tried to construct some kind of intellectual property jurisprudence based on the extension of principles in halacha that don't have very much direct bearing on the subject. So this kind of a cacophony of different ideas, different svaras. But one of the most interesting sources is a tshuva of the Shaul Meshiv, Rabbi Nathanson. He recounts, he was a strong advocate, he believed very much in intellectual property, and he cites as follows. He was talking about a sefer, actually, but he says there was some guy in Russia, apparently Russia, Poland, who developed some kind of adding machine, some kind of early mechanical calculator. And he says, and the government in Warsaw, he says, pays him royalties for the use of his invention. He says, Kol Yomav Kibel Scharo Me'akira Bavasha. All his days he received what we would call royalties from the government in Warsaw, he says. And then he says, Lo Yehei Torah Shlema Shalanu Kesicha B'Teila Shalahem. Our Torah cannot be behindhand from any other system of law. This is an incredibly powerful, incredibly innovative principle. That any time secular law has some kind of concept that we think is logical and sensible and something that we ought to have, even if we can find no direct source for it in halacha, simply by, he cuts the Gordian knot and just says that's it. If they have it, we ought to have it too. Rav Yehuda Silman, another distinguished contemporary of Bnei Brak Dayan, he actually is not entirely excited about this, but he makes an argument, which is he doesn't dispute the basic idea of Rabbi Nathanson. He just says that he makes another very provocative point. He says that the Torah's jurisprudence is founded fundamentally on principles of ownership and rights. He says the Goyim, he claims, I don't know exactly what his sources are for theories of modern Western law, but he says the Goyim, he says their theories are, the non-Jews, he says their theories of law are based more on notions of equity, what they think is right, but not grounded in the lumdus of ownership and rights. Therefore, he says it's difficult to directly derive law from one system to the other. But he doesn't challenge Rabbi Nathanson's fundamental assumption that halacha can look at the law and say, if this is what the law says, we ought to have a similar concept. He just says you have to take into account the fundamentally different nature of the systems. So obviously this is a profoundly important and potentially has enormous ramifications in halacha. We're not really going to do much with this. I'm just mentioning this by way of introduction as just an example of some of the perspectives taken by poskim toward the influence on halacha of foreign law. So what we're going to focus on today mostly is the question of din malchus adina, the principle that the law of the land is binding in halacha. Now, din malchus adina is an extremely difficult topic to discuss. There are very few gemaras that deal with this in Shas. There are just three or four gemaras scattered throughout Shas. There is no systematic treatment of the topic. So there are three questions, three groups of questions about Din Malchusa, which are all very unclear and all the subject of major disputes among the poskim. First of all, and they're all overlapping and related, but there are three groups of problems or questions about Din and Malchusa. First question is, what is the rationale, the justification, the basis for the principle of Din and Malchusa Dina? As we've said, the Gemara simply has literally a three-word statement, Din and Malchusa Dina. The law of the land is the law, meaning is the law accepted by halacha. The Gemara gives us no explanation for how do we know, is this halacha Moshe B'Sinai, is this a drasha, is this a svara, is this something that we have to do to avoid to keep good relations with our non-Jewish neighbors. So we don't know the rationale or the source. Now the poskim have given many, many suggestions. Rishonim and Achronim have offered many different suggestions for why this should be, why halacha recognizes the law of the land. And all the suggestions obviously have ramifications, have consequences for the technical details of when we do and we do not apply the rule of Din and Malchusa. So for example, the Rashbam in Bava Basra is widely quoted. He essentially adopts what in modern terms we would call a kind of enlightenment consent of the governed theory, that the government's power derives from the consent of the populace for the government to govern them. He says, Hiskimu b'nei Medina, the citizens, the residents of a country agree to accept the legitimacy, to accept the authority of a government, and then that government's laws are then binding. Some poskim argue that it's just a pasuk, it's a drasha, like any other halachan chosh mishpat. That Hashem tells us in the Torah that Din Malchusa is to be binding. Other poskim understand that more specifically that the Torah wrote the parasha of Melech, that the Melech has certain rights, and that these rights are included in the rights of the Melech. But the point is that the source and consequently the rationale behind Din Malchusa is very unclear, which a fact which has major ramifications for discussing the practical question of when Din Malchusa does not apply, does or does not apply. That is the second category of Din Malchusa, the most important one, which is very unclear. When do we say Din Malchusa Dina and when not? Almost all posts can agree that we don't simply discard the entire Shulchan Aruch and say, let's go to law school and simply follow secular law. The Gemara gives maybe a half dozen examples of when we actually do say Din Malchusa. The most basic one, which the poskim all agree to, is taxation. The government has the right to collect taxes. And the Gemara therefore says that therefore the government is not considered gazlanim, they're not considered thieves when they take your taxes. If a highwayman demands that you pay him money or else, and by power of force he extracts money from you, that's theft. If the government does the same thing, taxation backed by the threat of force, that is not theft. That is considered legitimate. The Gemara says, therefore, when the government confiscates property and uses it to build bridges, we're allowed to use those bridges. The government is not considered gazlan. So taxation is the one area where virtually all poskim agree that Din Malchusa Dina does apply. Similarly, currency. The establishing a system of currency and regulating currency, that is something which poskim generally accept that Din Malchusa does govern. Almost everything else is machlokes. Almost every other example of when Din Malchusa of where poskim try to invoke Din Malchusa is the subject of dispute. Some poskim say Din Malchusa is limited to real property, karka. Some poskim say it isn't. Some poskim say Din Malchusa is limited to where the government has a direct vested interest, like the examples we gave of taxation and currency. Some poskim say there's no such restriction. So the most expansive view is the view mentioned by the Ramah in Shin Samach Tes, I think. The Ramah says that anything which is for the Toves Bnei Medina, anything which is for the general welfare of society, for the citizenry, we do accept Din Malchusa. Many poskim, though, have problems with this. They say the Ramah can't possibly mean that we should discard all of Chosh and Mishpat in favor of the law. So the poskim try to explain what the Ramah meant, what we may get a chance to see some examples of interpretations of the Ramah, qualifications of what the Ramah meant. So that's the second question of the Din Malchusa, which is just the basic halacha, the basic rules in Shulchan Aruch and the later poskim, when do we say Din Malchusa and when do we not? The third question is actually not a question you'll find acknowledged explicitly by the poskim, but in a way is the most fascinating, at least from a theoretical perspective of all, which is, what kind of political philosophy, what kind of hashkafa toward laws do the poskim accept? The poskim don't address this front and center, but as we will see from some of the sources we'll discuss in the context of rent control later, poskim have had very different attitudes toward government, its proper role. And just like today, we can argue about Republicans and Democrats. We can argue whether national health care is a good idea. The postcum don't address this question directly, but we will see surprisingly different, diametrically opposed attitudes by the postcum. Some of them sound like right-wing talk shows where they talk about how this law is a socialist law, it's meant to redistribute wealth, which is against the Torah. Other poskim will say that's an attitude we'll see later of the Chavetz Chaim HaSharon. Other poskim say exactly the opposite. Rav Henkin, 50 years ago, wrote that, no, rent control is wonderful. The fact that it privileges the poor and discriminates against rich landowners is wonderful. That's the job of the law, to stick up for the poor and oppressed in society. That's what good government is supposed to be. So these kind of considerations of what the poskim thought, what his kind of political philosophy was, what he thought the role of government was, and what kind of laws he thought were a good idea or not, will play some role in the halacha. We will see. The poskim don't usually make that the paramount consideration, but we will see the poskim definitely invoke their hashkafic ideas about the role of law and the role of government as arguments, or at least to buttress their arguments about what sorts of laws Din Malchusa does apply to and not. As a matter of fact, one of the tshuvas which is very commonly quoted in this context is the tshuva of the Chasam Sofer in Choshen Mishpat Siman Mem Dalet. Chasam Sofer basically says, he mentions a litmus test for Din Malchusa. He says we don't have sovereign power today. He says in the time of Chazal and in the earlier generations they had the community, certainly when they had a monarchy and even when they had autonomous or semi-autonomous communities that were able to legislate their own rules, their own regulations. He says, today we don't have that. So he says, if the government passes a law, which is the sort of thing that we would do if we had control, then yes, then we say Din Malchusa, he says. And many posts can invoke this. And obviously, this is a delicious formulation because it leaves you open to the basic question, what is an example of a law that we would pass if we were in control? If you're a conservative or libertarian, the answer to that question is very different than if you are a modern liberal or otherwise, socialist. So the poskim do try to answer this question by comparing the law to examples that Chazal gave, but the devil's in the details, and how do Gimadam Milstol Milsa, how to compare a modern law to the laws of Chazal, how to decide what Chazal would have approved of, is obviously a very tricky matter. Now, the Imre Yosher, Meir Arik, does actually limit this Chasam Sofer very much. Well, he's discussing in the context of rent control, he says that it really has to resemble Chazal's laws very, very closely. But I don't think, well, maybe we'll discuss exactly what he meant by that later, but I don't think that other posts necessarily agree with that. I believe that some posts can understand the Chasam Sofer more broadly, that we simply have to evaluate a law, whether it's according to the Hashkafa and the spirit of Chazal, which obviously leaves you open to making a judgment call about what sorts of laws are in the spirit and the judgment are in the spirit of what Chazal did. Now, Din Malchusa, again, especially in contemporary times, is treated somewhat differently than the way it was in the time of Chazal and the earlier poskim. Now, I understand that there are basically three things that have changed very much from the situation that existed in the time of the Gemara or 1,000 years ago in the time of the Rishonim. The first one simply has to do with the scope of government. Back then, the governments did legislate, like even in the time of the Gemara, they passed certain commercial legislation, but the overweening the overweening spread of government so far into daily life was something, I'm not a historian, I'm sure the matter is rather more complicated than this, but my understanding is that governments today, thousands and thousands of pages of federal code, state laws, all kinds of executive branches with the executive bodies with regulations, there's simply a lot more government than there ever was. In the time of Chazal, we could say the law says certain things, and after that, we can go our own way and follow halacha. Today, there's just so much law. One of the libertarians writing against the encroachment of federal government has a book, I think, showing that a typical person violates 3 felonies a day or something. If an overzealous prosecutor, the kind who can indict a ham sandwich, can find you guilty of 3 felonies a day. Whether that's an exaggeration or not, but clearly there's just a whole lot more law. The law just governs so much more of daily life than it ever did, which means that there are simply going to be a lot more conflicts between the law and halacha than perhaps there used to be 1,000 years ago. Second issue has to do with the autonomy of the Jewish communities. Certainly when we had our own government, at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and the first Beis HaMikdash especially, obviously we were much more independent, but even in the medieval period, the Jewish communities were very autonomous. I mean, even taxation, the government would very often simply tell the community, we need 10,000 rach taler from you, and then you have the dirty work of deciding how it should be divvied up among your citizens. And the governments gave the Jews a great deal of regulatory power to police their own affairs. This changed basically in the Enlightenment, where the governments took away a lot of the Jewish autonomy. That's why you'll often see in Sfarim, whenever they talk about Cherem, you'll always see a little star saying when the government used to permit it. This is apparently one of the great battles of the Enlightenment. Cherem was one of the great tools by which Jews policed themselves, and the governments of Europe fought a battle to take away the Cherem because they wanted more control, they wanted to dissolve the separatism of the Jewish communities, they wanted to have sole police power. That's the line about, you know, government is the body that has a monopoly on the use of force. You know, they wanted sole enforcement power. And the flip side of that is that also with Enlightenment is assimilation. Jews normally simply moved in different circles, and they didn't even though they did business with the non-Jews, they policed their own affairs. They had their own communities. With the Enlightenment, you know, Jews were able to be non-religious. Jews were able to assimilate. And so even in America today, even though the pendulum has swung back from the terrible assimilation of 50 years ago, now we're stronger and prouder. We have more laws. But the fact is that we are much more deeply mingled and deeply intertwined with secular society than we used to be. And we will see several poskim explicitly acknowledge this as a reason why Din Malchusa should have more power and more sway than it used to in earlier periods. The third factor related to what we were speaking before about political theory is the question of the roles of government. In the old days, you know, the king, whether he thought he ruled by divine right or whether he thought he was God or for whatever he thought, I think it was Louis XIV, the Sun King, one of the French kings who famously said, "The state, it is I." I'm not going to try to pronounce the French version of that. But they believed that the subjects existed for them very often, and then they believed that they were a sufficient cause for themselves. They would legislate whatever they felt like. Today, we seem to have made progress. You know, much of the world lives in democratic governments, that the government are simply representatives of the people, and they're supposed to legislate on behalf of the people. And not only that, but even the dictatorships in the world, many of them will piously pronounce that people like Assad or Gaddafi are talking about how the people love them, they're the saviors of the people, and they're doing things all for the sake of their people. Today there's much more of a sense that the legitimacy of a government derives from the people, whether it's by actual consent of the governed or not. But today legislation is officially or actually targeted more at the good of society. And that is something which, as we shall see, many poskim explicitly acknowledged as a reason to care more about what the Din Malchusa says. So after the introduction, now we'll discuss how many of these factors, many of these considerations, play out in the subject of rent control itself. So the first thing we have to understand is what the halacha actually says about rent control. The answer to that is very little. Halacha here, as in most areas, is fairly laissez-faire. Freedom of contract is essentially the governing principle. Whatever the landlord or the tenant make up is binding. There are a group of halachas which grant certain protections to the tenant. Chazal were misaken certain rules to protect tenants from being thrown out and not have a place to live. But those rules are very limited. The most important thing to understand is that these rules are only really relevant in the absence of any lease with a fixed term. A lease with a fixed term, those rules are not relevant at all. The day the lease expires, the tenant has to leave that day. And also, even these things can be overridden by any stipulation in the contract. So although these halakhas are still relevant sometimes today, in most practical situations, certainly where a lease contract exists, the few basic protections halakha has for tenants are not relevant. The law in many states and in many jurisdictions has a different attitude. The law often does award certain protections for the tenants, and these protections are essentially of two sorts. The first one is that a tenant may often not be evicted at all, as long as he's willing to pay rent. As long as he's able and making payments, he cannot be evicted. The second group of protections forbids the landlord from raising the rent beyond some regulated, legislated, some set increase per year, for example. These are the two sorts of protections that the laws tend to grant tenants. And these are, postmen have all acknowledged that these laws are essentially in conflict with halacha. Halacha will generally allow the landlord to simply tell the tenant to take a hike. And the law often awards the tenant much more protection. I don't know the story in Philadelphia, but in New York City is one of the famous rent control areas. But as we'll see, these shalos began to be discussed primarily in the early 20th century, after the dislocations, the demographic disturbances of World War One, housing stock was destroyed, people, refugees, whatever the issues were, governments in Europe began to legislate for the protection of tenants, and the poskim began to be asked whether halacha, if there are two Jews and the landlord says, I want to throw you out, and the tenant says, I want to invoke protection of the law, so I'm assuming they're both willing to follow halacha, what does halacha say? What should they do? So the first great dispute was around 1920 between two of the great European poskim, Rav Meir Arik of Tarna and Rav David Menachem Manis Babad of Tarnopol. As described by Rav Meir Arik's Talmud, Rav Yeshua Menachem Ehrenberg, he was a Talmud Mufak of Rav Meir Arik. He has a funny anecdote about that. He was a famous Rabbi Nudayan in the 70s, 80s. So he has a discussion of Sherut Lumi in his Tshuvas. And he introduces his Tshuva by saying that while the great controversy of Sherut Lumi, of national service for women, was going on in Israel, he says he was against it, like most of the Haredi Rabbanim were, but you know, he felt it wasn't his place, it wasn't his battle, so he didn't do anything. So one night he said he had a dream in which his great Rebbe, Rav Meir Arik, came to him and said, why aren't you doing anything? Get up and protest. So he said, who am I? He said, the great Gedolim who are fighting the battle, what role do I play? Who's going to listen to me? So Meir Arik said, absolutely not. He says, in Katan Atah Beinecha, you may be small in your own eyes. I was Samech Yadi Alai. I laid hands on you. I appointed you as a Rav Amar of Yisrael. I want you to get out there and protest. So I woke up, Rav Ehrenberg said, and I said, all right, Debrei Chalomos Lamalav Lamaridin, I don't listen to dreams. So I went back to my business. But then I pulled out the morning's paper, he said, and I saw Moshe Sharet, minister of the government, saying, we're willing to talk to the Rabbanim. As long as they're willing to explain to us what their issues are, we'll talk to them. Let's have a conversation about it. So, all right, said Rav Ehrenberg, if they want to hear, it's my duty to talk to them. So he wrote a whole tshuva about Sherut Lumi. Anyway, the point is, Rav Ehrenberg was a Talmud Mufak of Rav Meir Arik, and he discusses the great machlokas between Rav Meir Arik and Rav David Menachem of Tarnopol about whether rent control is binding according to halacha or not. As he summarizes the discussion, both of them basically agreed that ultimately it's machlokas, that it's machlokas aposkim, based on all those technical considerations we said earlier, do we accept Yom Malchusa only when there's a direct government interest, or anytime it's for the benefit of society? And he said, they both say it's machlokas. The bottom line difference of opinion was, what do we do now that it's machlokas? Who's considered muksuk? Which way should halacha go? So the details are quite technical and complicated and not relevant to us, but they argued, Rav Meir Arik ultimately ruled in favor of the tenant, and Rav Babad ultimately ruled in favor of the landlord. But Rav Ehrenberg's synopsis is misleading, because although he says that they're basically on the same page, except for the question of who's muksuk, of which way to resolve the dispute, that is not really the case. Because if you look at the tshuvas, you will see that Rav Meir Arik is very sympathetic to the law. He keeps referring to the fact that it's a Torah Gadol, and there's a great need to do this, and it's such an important piece of legislation. While the Chavetz Chaim Sharon and Rav Abad, he had an entirely different attitude. He refers, he sneers at the law. He says that this is the law of the communists and the socialists, and its job is to redistribute wealth. And such a law, he says, is absolutely unacceptable. He writes that. Anyway, as I said, I have a quote somewhere here, but he says that after going through this law is machlokes, and he thinks that the socher is muksik and then the masker is muksik, he says, Befrat, he says that this law was one of the new laws made by the new deputies to parliament, the socialists and the communists, whose goal is to redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor, an attitude which is hepuch das tarasenu. And even though it's a minhag, he says, it's not a minhag vasikim, it's a flawed minhag, it's a bad minhag. And he was not very keen on following rent control. And going down through the generations, we basically find both these perspectives have ample support in the poskim. We find another one who was skeptical of the law was the Marshag, another one of the great Eastern European poskim. He said no, and he makes an argument which really cuts to the debate, the whole political debate, the whole Ashkafic debate going on here. He writes, Hein emes la sochrim hu tova v'tikun. It is true, he says, that this law clearly, he's discussing the Ramah standard of tova v'tikun b'nei medina, for the good and for the benefit of the citizenry. He says, yes, you're right. He says, for the tenants, it's a good idea. It's tova v'tikun. Avol balabayis amaskiru kilkav l'chazar. But for the landlords, it's a terrible idea. You're taking away property, you're giving property, you're taking away his right to his property, and you're awarding it to somebody else. Who told you to look at things from the perspectives of the tenants and call this a good idea? Look at it from the perspective of landlords. For them, it's simply the government taking of property unfairly. So even according to the Ramah, he says, who says that anything for the good of the populace is valid in Malchusa. This is simply privileging one sector of society against another. And this essentially, in a nutshell, obviously, is the entire political question of all economic policy. Most legislation is going to affect one class in society at the expense of another. Is that called Tikkun B'nei Medina, or is that not called Tikkun B'nei Medina? Rashad says absolutely not. Simply choosing one segment of society and say, we're going to help you, and we're going to do that by taking property from another segment, that's not fair, he says. That's not right. Who gives you the right to do that? And he therefore basically said, that's not the Malchusa. And what did the Ramah mean? The Ramah meant very specific cases having to do with finding lost property, which are basically for the good of everybody, and everybody could find himself in that situation. And that's the only, with there's no element of class warfare, no element of privileging one group over another, that's the only case the Ramah meant when he talked about, Tovus Namadina. But any case where you're privileging one segment against another, that is absolutely not acceptable. Another one of the opponents of Din Malchusa was Rabbi Yeshua Pinchas Bambach, brought by the Fis Eliezer. He has very sharp language also against rent control. He was writing, I think, mid-20th century, but he says, if you would actually follow the law, he says, in such a thing, Tarek Lazov Das Tara Choshen Mishpa, we'd have to abandon the Torah, Lilmud La'olam Dine B'chuke we'd have to learn the laws and the regulations of the non-Jews. They lay the lifsa kadin Torah, the davar zeh yishtakev layomer. It's chas v'shalom, he says. Chas v'shalom lomer daideh chok b'nyan eschiru kishuna din ha-Torah kdosh. Chas v'shalom to say that the law should override what the halacha says in this area. There are, however, other poskim throughout the 20th century who have agreed to Rameir Arik that we do say din malchusa. Notably, we have Chabina Rav, Rav Dov Gerish Wiedenfeld, in his Dov of Mesharim. He says most poskim say that we follow the Ramah, that Tov as a klal is anything that's for the general good of society. We do say Dina Malchusa. And he mentions the Chum Sefer, who says that the standard is what kind of things we would do. And since Chazal themselves made some, at least some limited protections, he says, but ultimately he means that Chazal did care about not having people thrown out and sitting on the streets. So we would do the same thing. Now, Rameir Arik himself is not actually so sure about that. Rameir Arik himself says that Chazal, even though they said you can't throw a tenant out, that was the first of the two protections. They said you can't toss them on the street. You can, however, raise the rent. You are allowed to raise the rent, not arbitrarily high, because that's equivalent to throwing them out. You can just say, I want, $10,000 a day. But Chazal say what you can do is you can raise the rent to the prevailing market rates. So Rameir Arik says, if you would apply this Chum Sefer, that's all you would get. You would say that the landlord cannot evict him to build a shopping mall, maybe, but he could say, okay, rents have doubled, now you have to pay me twice as much, and if you don't pay, you can evict him. So, but the Dov Mesharim, similarly, Rav Adya Hadaya, one of the great Sardik Rabbanutayanim in the last century, also felt very strongly that rent control, he compares it to local institutions of the Zayin Tuva Ha'er. He says it's a legitimate function of government to regulate rent, and it's a great idea. One of the really famous proponents of rent control, as we mentioned earlier, is Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin is in his Tshuvas Ivra. Rav Henkin was having a dispute with another posek who was much more skeptical, like the Chavetz Chaim Sharer of rent control. And Rav Henkin takes a very democratic, with a capital D, approach to the whole thing. Among other things, he mentions the point I mentioned earlier that things have changed today. He says, "Bizmanu v'makom she'ein li Yisrael batei dinin." In eras where the Jews don't have their own bastions, then HaMashallah Chokekes Kukum L'Tavas Ha'am, then the government legislates. B'Dorim Shomalon, HaKol Chayav Linuk B'Dinei HaMashallah. And when I come to Bastin, B'Frat, he says, B'Dina Constitutionalis, in our constitutional, a government of laws, not of men, Shachukum Nasim L'Dinei B'Chorei Ha'am B'Yehudim B'Tacham, representative government is a factor strongly in favor of accepting such laws as valid. And he writes specifically about rent control. He writes, Chal kadiru shalem amshala, rent control legislation, hu yashar, mesuka, nu mekubal. It is right, it is accepted, it is appropriate. He says, even if sometimes it's unfair, sometimes it may unfairly deprive someone of property. All laws like that, he says, kein derech achok, pamam nifka b'yosher. Sometimes the law, you know, makes a mistake. But the law, the fact that it distinguishes between diros anim, lebate luxus, to luxury apartments, ena megarei achok, el madifo, that's an advantage to the law. Matei ol tzad yosher, that's the law's job, to help out the poor. And that's what he says. And similarly, we mentioned Rav Bambach before, who used very sharp language against rent control, but he himself, in the next tshuva, his son reports that he had an about-face when he said that all the limitations of Din Malchusa in earlier generations were all where, as we said, where the king made rules and he was accountable to no one and he did what he wanted. Then the post can discuss what rights does he have or what rights are restricted, what can he not do, he says. But today, where we have representative government, and the government is simply the agents of the people, you can argue whether that's the theory that they teach in civics, whether how responsive the government really is, how well the system works in practice. But the bottom line is, we do live in a democracy. We're representative democracies, but today's governments are democratic. They are the voice of the people. Therefore, he says, that is binding. We don't apply all... This is a tremendous chiddush. The Poskim in general, I think, do not go with this. Poskim in general do seem to assume, even Rameir Arik and the Rav Babad, they were also arguing about more or less modern democracies, and they still felt that the laws of Din Malchusa apply, and that is the consensus of most poskim. But as we see, people like Rav Henkin were willing to consider the fact that we live in a constitutional government, we live in a democratic government where the people's representatives legislate, and that makes all the difference. The one last aspect of this discussion, which we alluded to all the way at the beginning, is the question of minhag. Up till now, most of the poskim that we've seen have approached the question of the law. Does the law have, in and of itself, validity according to halacha? What laws? What kind of laws? Many poskim, though, have argued that we're asking the wrong question, that there's no need to consider whether Din Malchusa is binding or not, because anything that the government establishes, at least a law which is well-known and typically followed, that itself will create a minhag, and minhagim are binding and in and of themselves, regardless of whether the source is a law or any other source. This position is most famously attributed to Rav Moshe in a couple of tshuvas. Rav Moshe expresses this eloquently at great length. He says, I don't want to discuss Din Malchusa, first of all, because it could cause bad relations and cause people to chas v'shalom be disrespectful to the government, and also because it's very complicated, he says, and it's a hard sugya and it's difficult to talk about. But he says, it's not relevant, he says. As long as the law was on the books at the time the tenant entered into his arrangement with the landlord, so as long as nothing was stipulated to the contrary, any contract they have is assumed to be in accordance with the law. Even if they write a specific time, he says that time is for the benefit of the tenant, that he has the right to leave before that. But the tenant's rights are also secured by the law. Now, obviously, the one issue here is going to be that if this is the whole argument, then you have the right to stipulate to the contrary. All the postmen who use this kind of argument all say, in the absence of any stipulation to the contrary, then in the case of a default contract, the law will control. The truth is, Rav Moshe was not the first to propose this. The first that I know of is the Erech Shai. Rav Shlomo Yehuda Tabak of Siget, one of the great Hungarian poskim from about a century ago, he made this point also very briefly. He wasn't even talking about a practical law. He just said it would follow, based on earlier sources, that any law which was on the books and is well known and is followed would become a minhag, and therefore would control, the same way that any minhag controls. And we don't care whether the source of the law, the source of the minhag happened to be a law. It's not worse than any other minhag. And a number of other poskim also adopt this view. Rav Shlomo Shimshon Karelitz, a nephew of the Chazon Ish, in his Sefer Atar Shlomo, also says that he discussed the question with the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish took for granted that Din Malchusa did not apply in this case. However, he said, because against the Torah, he says, it's basically what we call depriving of a property without due process. Simply taking away somebody's house is against the Torah, he says. However, he says, if the law was on the books at the time that the tenant entered the house, then it would create a minhag, and the minhag would control. So Rav Moshe held this way, the Erech Shai held this way, Atar Shlomo held this way, and there are, however, detractors. Not everyone, we're just about done, just wrap this up. There are, however, some arguments that can be made against this kind of argument. The Chavetz HaSharon, Rav Babad, in his comments about the socialists and the communists, He mentions the fact that it was a minhag, but he dismisses it and says that it's not a minhag vasikin. So, as we mentioned right at the beginning, minhag and halacha play several different roles. Rav Moshe focuses on the idea of minhag as simply any default contract is assumed to have been entered into according to the terms of the prevailing custom. And then he says, why should it make a difference who made it up? Fasikin, not Fasikin, non-Jews, Jews, who cares? As long as that is the custom and that was the assumption of the parties. The Chavos El Sasharon insists on Minhag Vasikin. And there are many sources in Halacha, in Chavos El Mishpat, but we do insist on Minhag Vasikin. And this is a complex topic, and the poskim don't often acknowledge that there are different ideas of Minhag, but in brief, the idea seems to be, sometimes we want to invoke Minhag as a kind of takana. A Minhag, even if it wasn't formally legislated by a Beis Din, can in certain cases establish a takana. But in such cases, it would have to be a Minhag Vasikin. It would have to be an old Minhag, a Minhag that was endorsed either explicitly or tacitly by the Chachamim of the city. So I don't know why the Chavos El Sasharon is not willing to consider Rav Moshe's kind of minhag as simply a minhag of a minhag that determines what the contracting parties meant. But he does insist that it has to be a minhag vasikim, and he's not interested in the fact that this is common practice. The Torah still, he says, should override such a degenerate minhag. And an interesting shuva from Shlomo Zalman, not really the same thing, but it is something worth remembering. Shlomo Zalman was asked about the right of workers to strike. This is an entirely different topic. I'll share this also. But Shlomo Zalman was asked about the rights of workers to strike. And one of the points he mentions is, he says, someone has suggested that, well, if the workers belong to a union, and the union typically strikes to get what it wants, and the employer hired him on that understanding, so maybe we should argue it's like a minhag. This is how employer-employee relations work in this society, that the employee makes demands, the employee negotiates with employer. If they can't agree, then there's a walkout or a lockout or whatever they do, and whoever wins. Shlomo Zalman says, no way, absolutely not, he says. He says, when the employer and the employee are both Jews, the employer can say, I thought you would follow Torah. I didn't think you would follow the laws of your union, the regulations of your labor groups. So even though one could have argued, like Rav Moshe does and the other posts can do by rent control, that just the opposite, that any time there is a well-defined practice, and certainly striking by now, by the 21st century, then there's an elaborate dance of rules, of laws, of customs, of when they strike and what they do. Nevertheless, again, I have to know exactly what situation he was talking about, but Shlomo Zalman simply dismisses this kind of argument by saying that we don't care about the fact that it's a minhag. The employer can say, I expected you to follow halacha, not the way the unions generally follow. But many poskim, as we've seen, the predominant view in the poskim probably is that the halacha does recognize the minhag, even if the minhag derives ultimately from a law. As we've seen, that's the opinion of Rav Moshe, and attributed to the Chazon Ish by his nephew, and as well as Baruch Shai, who was one of the great Hungarian poskim. So, but as I said, the one problem with this approach is that this by definition, this mahalach of minhag, that minhag determines what the contracting parties really meant when they entered into a default contract, this is only true if the contract specifies nothing to the contrary. If this is the whole argument, then the contracting parties would have the right to say, this contract shall not be governed according to rent control, at which point the only justification would be Din Malchus HaDinah, which, as we've seen, is a complex and difficult topic, both in terms of the technical halachas as well as sometimes the hashgafic perspectives of the poskim discussing it. Okay. Thank you for listening.